The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, hello there. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974, and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. Thank you, Carter Glass! They can be reached at 919-781-1973 for all your insurance needs. And now we're going to return to the March 2021 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month is the mighty Roanoke River, also known as the Amazon of North Carolina. We're going to be reading some non-Amazon of the North Carolina articles today. We're going to start with Friendship by Design. At first, a new house in Raleigh's historic Oakwood neighborhood spurred controversy among residents who did not want contemporary next to traditional. Now, two friends, one a modernist architect, the other a historic preservationist, have helped bring their community back together through a mutual respect for each other and a passion for beautiful homes. Written by Bridget Buher. In 2013, Raleigh's historic Oakwood neighborhood found itself in the international spotlight when longtime residents protested the appropriateness of a contemporary home under construction on Euclid Street. The controversy pitted neighbor against neighbor and the Raleigh Board of Adjustment in opposition to the city's Historic Development Commission. It generated press coverage in Dwell, Vanity Fair, the New York Times, and London's Daily Mail. In time, homeowners Lewis Cherry and Marcia Gordon were allowed to complete their 2,100-square-foot dream house. And 8 years later, a deep friendship has emerged from the ordeal. Today, when Oakwood resident Matthew Brown hops on his bicycle and cruises over to his buddy Cherry's home, the half-mile trip is a journey forward in time, from the 19th century to the 21st century. Brown is a highly respected historic preservationist who's restored three Oakwood homes, including the one he lives in, an 1896 structure on nearby Persons Street known as the Lamar Brown Arthur House. It's a wondrous paean to the ornate details and sumptuous interiors, particular to the Queen Anne architectural style. Brown, who serves on the board of directors of the Society for the Preservation of Historic Oakwood, has researched the history of every house in the neighborhood, which was designed, or rather designated, a National Register Historic District in 1974. When he moved to Oakwood in 1986, he paid $270 a month to rent half a house. Today, he tells colorful stories about the area's beginnings in the 1870s when chickens and livestock roamed freely and horse-drawn buggies traversed down the dirt roads. Cherry, by contrast, is a celebrated modernist architect whose designs include light-filled libraries in Chatham, Durham, and Wake County, the J.C. Ralston Arboretum Visitor and Education Centers, the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Raleigh, and buildings at the Penland School of Craft near Spruce Pine. Cherry has helped shape the Triangle's dining scene, too, by bringing both form and function to a dozen restaurants, including those of culinary stars Ashley Christensen, Death and Taxes, Poolside Pies, and Scott Crawford, Crawford and Son, Jolie. And Cherry has created stunning residential homes that are both aesthetically refined and environmentally responsible. Brown and Cherry first met decades before in the 1970s through musical circles. Brown is a classical singer and trombonist, and Cherry's primary instrument is the guitar. For years, both men attended an annual invitation-only musical festival in North Carolina called The Boogie. Their social circles have overlapped since, but the two men became more closely connected after Cherry and Gordon began building their home in Oakwood. You might assume that a preservationist like Brown would have sided with the neighborhood's Not in My Historic Backyard Brigade, but you'd be wrong. Sitting in Cherry's airy living room, gazing out at the gently billowing bamboo stalks that shade a wood and concrete patio, Brown recalls what he told the Raleigh Historic Development Commission as the controversy played out. Even though this house is mostly modernist, it has a lot of elements that tie into the historic architecture of Oakwood, he said, referring to the house's traditional shallow-pitched roof, its wooden siding, and its black window sashes. All of those things can be found on houses throughout Oakwood. What's more, Oakwood's historic houses, like Cherry's contemporary home, were constructed by highly skilled craftsmen using fine materials, and the structures were meant to last forever. Brown looks around the space inside Cherry's home. This house is in keeping with that tradition of high-quality design and high-quality materials, he says. Cherry repays the compliment, noting how he was first struck by the exterior of Brown's home and its majestic proportions. It's a gorgeous house, Cherry says. Because of my profession, when I look at architecture, it isn't a matter of whether I like something or not. It's more a matter of assessing how a design fits into the history of architecture and that particular architectural style and how it's been cared for and whether it remains true to its original intention. When he first stepped inside Lamar Brown Arthur House, Cherry was bowled over by its restoration. Matthew's house is one of the finest examples of a fully realized vision of an architectural design and philosophical moment in history, Cherry says. It's a profoundly exquisite place to be and to experience. While the Cherry Gordon house reflects Cherry's personal sensibilities and professional expertise, the Lamar Brown Arthur house is a realization of Brown's long-standing desire to transform a diamond in the rough into his own residential masterpiece. His Victorian house had changed hands several times, was divided into apartments, and was then sold to the state of North Carolina, which bought properties near the Capitol to convert into offices. In 2003, the state announced that it would sell the properties, but it was another 12 years before the homes were actually made available to the buyers. Brown bided his time, and in 2015, he was finally able to make the winning bid on his house. The restoration and renovation of the two-story, 3,500-square-foot structure had been a labor of love and a significant financial investment. No detail was too small. Layers of exterior paint were removed and replaced with the dark greens and reds found in Queen Anne palettes. Galvanized downspouts were replaced with copper. Molding knives were created to replace the missing Eastlake interior woodwork. Not only has the Lamar Brown Arthur House become an architectural showpiece, but it also became part of the life of the community. Groups use the home for events and fundraisers, and it has been a highlight of the annual Historic Oakwood Candlelight Tour. As Brown and Cherry's friendship deepened, the two discovered a shared childhood experience of realizing the power of architecture and design to capture the imagination. Both men's fathers designed modernist homes. My dad designed a modern ranch house, and we had Danish furniture, the Bertoia and Saarinen chairs, all of that, Brown says. So I grew up liking that. And then, somewhere around 1970, my father decided he liked antiques, and we gradually got rid of all the modernist stuff and got antiques. Inspired by Frank Lloyd Wright, Cherry's father created a modern house that garnered curiosity among the family's neighbors. This was in Grifton, North Carolina, which is a teeny-weeny little rural town, Cherry says. But people were reading magazines and watching television and were aware of the idea of living better through design. So I think people were probably proud that their town had some of these modern designs. It wasn't until Cherry enrolled at North Carolina State University's College of Design that he got a more formal awakening to the building blocks of modernist design and how those blocks could be reconfigured. I was attracted to Bauhaus, the idea of functionalism and beauty, and to Shaker designs, which is a perfect balance of form and function, Cherry says. I started to understand how flexible modernism is to create space and light and views. It allows a lot of room for creative development of a design. That marriage of function and beauty resonates with Brown, too, although he is drawn to the Victorian era's embrace of eclectic ornamentation, opulent furnishings, distinct demarcation of rooms, and cozy warmth rather than bright expanses. You don't just have a chair, he says. You have a chair that has carvings of animals or flowers or geometric patterns. And instead of just putting a piece of art on the walls, you have wallpaper by William Morris or the Herder Brothers, and the whole wall is art. As the afternoon light arcs across the living room at the Cherry Gordon house, the two friends continue to articulate more common ground than differences. A shared appreciation for Tibetan Buddhist paintings known as thangkas, the way a window serves to frame passing clouds or swaying trees, how a doorway outlines a view to the next room, creating an inviting complement of patterns and textures, the frisson of excitement when discovering the perfect lamp or chair or piece of art that stirs and expands one's aesthetic experience. I think that people are either born with an innate sense of aesthetic appreciation or not, Brown says. My house reflects my own personal aesthetic outlook and my preference for Queen Anne architecture and Victorian styles. But every time I come over to Lewis's house, I just stop and say, that's beautiful, the shapes and forms, the beautiful siding, the plants in the yard. It's not logical. It's a feeling and a sensibility. Cherry nods. I'm so much more interested in quality than a style, he says. I could care less about any style. It's either beautifully done or it's not. And that, to me, has nothing to do with style. The well-done things are always going to look good. And with that, the historic preservationist bids goodbye, for now, to the modernist architect. Brown hops on his bike and begins pedaling away from one of Oakwood's most visible and well-known examples of architectural and aesthetic excellence and back toward another one. You're listening to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. Comments, questions? 919-832-5138. And now, Whispers in the Wood. In Pitt County, a luthier's handcraft guitars are sometimes discolored or full of knots. Some are shaped like snakes or shotguns. Each instrument's story starts with the wood used to make it. And while the past may have left its scars, beauty can be found in the sights and sound of art. Written by Mark Kemp. Guitars hang from the ceiling of the Greenville Museum of Art's West Wing Gallery like strange fruit from an unknown tree. They're not typical instruments. Oh, sure, some of them have the familiar shapes and colors of vintage electric guitars manufactured by big companies like Fender or Gibson, but the wood is different, knotty, rough, discolored in places. One is shaped more like a mandolin or a lute, but it has six strings, so it's a guitar. Other pieces hang from the museum's walls or are enclosed in glass cases. They're even stranger, like fruit that's rotted, dripped down the trunk of a tree, and dried into shapes that look like a shotgun, a pair of serpents, a human skull. But some of those pieces, too, have six strings, so they're guitars. Jazz singer Billie Holiday once sang of southern trees that bear strange fruit. If the hanging tree guitars exhibit bears any resemblance to her song, then what she sang resonates even more profoundly. The man who created these pieces, 78-year-old Freeman Vines, didn't start out making guitars as art. Vines was 8 years old when a white man who lived in the same area of Greene County near Snow Hill taught him how to play a few country songs on a Martin acoustic. Vines started making his own guitars in the late 1950s, untrained, a teenager crafting instruments for the musicians in his family's gospel group, the Glorifying Vines Sisters. Today, Vines makes guitars for himself and for exhibitions by the Music Maker Relief Foundation. The Hillsboro nonprofit preserves America's musical traditions by providing support, financial and otherwise, to marginalized musicians who were never signed to big record labels, but whose art has contributed value to our lives and perspective to the stories of our intertwined cultures. Vines doesn't make guitars to sell. He's declined offers of thousands for his work. He makes them because he's compelled to make them. He's an artist. It's what he does. Half an hour west of Greenville sits the town of Fountain, a tiny rural community of about 400, surrounded by sprawling tobacco and cotton fields at the western edge of Pitt County. The main drag is like a ghost town on this Friday afternoon. Not a soul in sight. The sound of a single reverberating guitar string breaks the silence. It's Vines, sitting on a couch inside his little storefront workshop, next to several of his instruments, including a banjo-like guitar he made from a drum head and a guitar that looks like a log. He's just plugged in his death mask, an instrument he made in 1967, and he's riffing on rudimentary blues licks, wailing tones that sound almost like the cries of a wounded animal, or human. Vines was about to retire from guitar making when one day in 2015, Tim Duffy wrote him a letter. Duffy, a folklorist, photographer, and co-founder of the Music Maker Relief Foundation, with his wife Denise, had heard about Vines and wanted to see his work. "I asked if I could come visit him," Duffy says, standing in the back of the shop as Vines continues playing. "When I got to his house and got out of the car, I saw this yard that was like an art installation," Duffy remembers. "He started pulling guitars out from underneath pieces of linoleum on the ground and out of an old shed." Duffy waves his hand around the shop where instruments in various stages of development lie on work tables. "And when he started pulling out all these guitars, it was clear to me that they weren't just guitars. This was art." Duffy took a series of dramatic, tintype photographs of Vines and his creations that day. The images are now a prominent part of the exhibit in Greenville and of Vines' memoir, Hanging Tree Guitars, published last year in cooperation with the Music Maker Relief Foundation. In the book, Duffy says of his first visit to Vines' home, "It had a sense of place, a beautiful place, even the way the debris was arranged. I learned later that it was all heavily manicured." Most luthiers build guitars using certain so-called tone woods, mahogany, walnut, maple, and Sitka spruce, to name a few, and design them for maximum comfort and playability. Vines uses some of those woods in his guitars, too, but he also works with whatever other materials he can find lying around his neck of Greene and Pitt counties, the sides of a dilapidated tobacco barn, the soundboard from an old Steinway piano, planks from a felled black walnut tree. Then he shapes the bodies into African masks, Yoruba spirits, creatures from nature, and other objects with ties to Eastern North Carolina's black history and culture. Although his guitars sound good and are not uncomfortable to play, those attributes are not top priority for Vines. What he looks for and listens for when crafting his instruments are the stories within the wood. "Wood talks to me," Vines says in Hanging Tree Guitars, his words shaped and printed onto the pages like blocks of poetry alongside contextualizing text by Zoe Van Buren, the folk life director at the North Carolina Arts Council. "Anybody got some old wood with some kind of character? It's like root, stuff that intrigues me." Vines' earliest attempts at guitar making were nothing special. "Me and you, we'd call them pieces of trash," the artist says with a gruff laugh, his death mask guitar now quiet, propped on his lap. You pick up an old plank, sand it down, chop it here and there, put a neck on it, play it three or four times, then chuck it in the barn. Over time, as he continued studying the mechanics of conventional guitars, Vines became a genuine luthier. The instruments not only began to look good, but they played well. I started shaping them a little better, he says. I made some pretty good instruments. I thought they was good. And when they got them on the stage, you could tell I made them. One day, Duffy asked Vines about a few pictures that the artist had taken of some old planks, as well as drawings he'd done of a guitar hanging from a tree. Vine had found the planks in a local man's barn. I was going down the dirt road one day, and I stopped and asked him, would he sell me some of that wood, Vine remembers. He said, yeah, go in there and look. But then he told me, he said, Freeman, you might not want to use that wood there, he said. They hung a man on that tree. I didn't pay no mind till Tim came by. Duffy was fascinated. When Freeman told me, these are hanging tree guitars, Guffy says, I was like, whoa, what a title. The folklorist did some research and determined that the black walnut tree that produced the planks had indeed been used for a lynching during the Jim Crow era. Tim had found conclusive evidence that the crime actually happened, Vine says. I told him, I said, Tim, I don't want to hear no more about it. Don't want to see nothing. Don't want to hear nothing, because I got to live around here. And Tim just went on, and he found out a lot of stuff that I'd never heard about. Vines pauses and gazes up at the ceiling. He sure did. With trepidation, Vines went to work on the wood, chopping, chiseling, and carving until images began to appear, including one of a human skull. He doesn't recall consciously creating a skull. He didn't know exactly what he'd created until he looked at the piece the next day. I reckon that spiritually and art-wise, see, I was looking at it as something unusual, Vines says. And then after my experience with that skull, everything turned different. Everything had significance. All you got to do is be able and willing to receive what it's trying to tell you. A tone is just a random sound until you listen for what it's saying. Vines has spent decades listening for a very specific tone that he heard one night after a day of work about 40 years ago. It was as if you had a large tuning fork about yay long, Vines says, raising his arms and extending his weathered hands about 2 feet from each other, and you banged it and was holding it, and that whole sound went over your body and then developed into a tone. When he talks about the experience, it becomes clear that Vines is not just looking for an auditory tone, but an overall hue, an impression, a reverberation, some kind of communication with voices from the past in this flat expanse of eastern North Carolina tobacco country. He's looking for a connection to history, a fraught history, an ugly history, and a meaningful history, all blended together as words and art and music. A tone. He shakes his head. It messed me up for a while, Vines says. I was already making guitars, so then I started looking for that tone. You really need a sound, though. It's more of a feeling, and it's hard to explain if you ain't never experienced it. Anyway, I thought if you could just keep going, just keep that sound and that tone with you as long enough, it won't make no difference whether you died or if you lived. It was so soothing and so comforting. Duffy speaks of Vines reverently. The guy's a genius, he says. He's just one of those guys. For years, he's been a contemporary artist who's been disguising his art as guitars. He kept all those guitars since 1958, so he had a huge collection. And the collection continues to grow. Back in Greenville, a certain tone quivers through the Art Museum's West Wing Gallery, enveloping the guitars hanging from the ceiling, the unfinished objects in glass display cases, and the ghost-like tintype images that Duffy shot of Vines and his guitars on the day they met. From a video monitor, Vines' voice echoes through what sounds like static from an old 50s radio broadcast. Only 4 of the instruments in the Hanging Tree Guitars exhibit were made from the black walnut tree that Vines found in that man's barn years ago, but together as a whole, all of the pieces tell the same story. It's a story of perseverance, insight and talent, of a time and place in history of our state, of a people's strength and ingenuity, of turning something painful into something beautiful. It's the story of an 8-year-old black child who learned to play country music on a guitar from a white man, and then discovered how similar that music was to the gospel and the blues he heard around his own home. It's the story of Freeman Vines, who had a vision one day and went on to dedicate his life to recreating that vision by carving into pieces of wood, unleashing their secrets in the form of beautiful but haunting music and art. The Hanging Trees guitar exhibit will be on display at the Greenville Museum of Art through March 6th. And I guess that date has passed. And at the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art in Winston-Salem from June 9th through September 15th. It can also be viewed virtually at, are you ready for this URL? exhibit.hangingtreeguitars.com. Well, we are almost out of time here, so I think what I'm going to do is use this opportunity to tell you about a photo here. There used to be three of them every issue, and now it's down to one. It's called The View From Here. It's a double-page spread. Let me read the description first. Opportunity abounds, Winston-Salem. Years ago, the buildings on the eastern end of downtown Winston-Salem were inundated with a heavy scent of tobacco. Now, those same buildings are filled with a buzz of research and discovery. The city's innovation quarter is the realization of more than 20 years of planning and construction. It's a symbol of new beginnings and a hub for more than 90 companies exploring opportunities in the medical, education, and digital fields, among others. And so, as the sun sets over the district, casting a sherbet-colored glow across the clouds, I'll have to remember that expression when I describe sherbet-colored glow across the clouds. The streetlights turn gold and bid the day farewell. What will tomorrow hold? Here, the possibilities seem endless. So what we have here is a view from downtown with some commercial buildings dominant in the foreground and the Winston Tower sticking up behind, along with it looks like it says Plant 64 at the top of a water tower that really stands up high, and a modernistic hotel or something on the left side, and Reynolds American, and another water tower on the right side, and there are sherbet-colored clouds in the background. Well, that's all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it. You'll join us next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions, comments, call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.